Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. A warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. I'm the Bill Arnold part of that sentence. How are you doing? Glad you are with me today. It's been a great show so far. If you missed any of it, go to myfaithradio.com and check it out. It's been a really great day, and this is going to be a fantastic hour with J. Warner Wallace. He's going to be on the program for the whole hour. And if you are just getting in your car and heading home, I hope you've had a good work week, and thanks for all you do, and you matter, and God loves you. And, you know, I'm thinking of how nice it is just to have a little downtime. And I was reading that these three astronauts just landed back on Earth after living in space for 197 days. Where do you live in space? Is that like at the space station? What is that? Is that like some kind of bad timeshare? I don't know. Do they have Sports Central up there? That'd be tough to be up there for 197 days. I also saw that Jeff Bezos is now ahead of Bill Gates in wealth by $63 billion. He's 63. That makes no sense to me. I would call Bill Gates and say, hey, you want to come clean my garage? I'll pay you. That is just unbelievable wealth. He has made $50 billion in the last 8 months. Crazy. All right. And, you know, I always go to Mark 8:36. What profits a man to win the whole world but lose his own soul? You can't give me any of that in exchange for my name written in the book of life. So that is what's ahead. James Warner Wallace is my guest. Can hardly wait. Be back in a minute.
Maybe you have that person in your life who you can sit with over a cup of coffee, and when they talk to you, it just makes sense. It's like their words are a beacon of hope. As you listen to Faith Radio, we long to make that kind of difference. You'll hear the unchanging wisdom of God's Word, truth that challenges you, love that embraces you, and tools that equip you to pass it along to others. The coffee is optional.
But it's nice.
Connecting faith to life. Faith Radio.
James 5:16 says, "The prayer of a righteous person is powerful and effective." Do you need prayer today? You can submit your prayer request to PrayerWorks, and people will pray for you. Just visit myfaithradio.com and click on PrayerWorks. Submit your request and take comfort knowing you are being lifted up. You can also pray for other requests while you're there. Receive prayer support through PrayerWorks at myfaithradio.com today.
I couldn't sleep at all last night.
Welcome back to the show. It's 7 minutes after the hour. J. Warner Wallace has spent a lot of his life in police work. He was a cold case homicide detective, and I think his father was in the business, and his son is in the business. So it's a family affair. And he was a vocal atheist until 35, and then he took a pretty serious look at the evidence and applied his skills at homicide detectiving. I think that's a word, detectiving, and really came up with a whole bunch of unbelievably solid material that is some of the most convincing and well-organized material out there for sharing Christ with your friends. And he's written a series of books for kids. And this is the third book in the series, and it's called Forensic Faith for Kids, Learn to Share the Truth from a Real Detective. And it's designed for kids. And I'm thinking as I read this book, I need to read more kids' books because it's so much fun, and it's so straightforward, and it's so beautifully and simply put that I go, I get this. Sometimes I pick up a book by, you know, some of the great, huge thinkers, and there are 1,200 pages, and I go, I can't read this. So anyway, this is a lot of fun to read, and he's going to be our guest for the whole hour. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Yeah, I think when we get a chance to, like all of us who are writing these kinds of books, we're just translators, right? We're standing on the shoulders of philosophers and historians and thinkers who are really a lot more articulate. They have their PhDs in these disciplines, you know, I have a master's degree in theology and I have a master's in architecture, but I don't have a PhD in some of the high-level sciences that we're talking about when we make a case for God's existence, or some of the historical methodologies that people use when they're making a case for Christianity. But what we're doing is we're trying to translate, because a lot of times when you listen to those experts, and this happens in jury trials all the time, right? We call an expert, mm-hmm. he comes up on the stand and he tells us something, and the jury's kind of scratching their head going, what in the heck did he just say? And so we've got to figure out a way to translate that testimony for jurors. And that's what we're kind of doing with every book we write about apologetics or about, you know, the case for Christianity. And when it comes to kids' books, you're even translating at a whole nother level. That and I actually enjoyed it because I felt like it really helped me declare. Look, when you have to translate to that level, you have to be very clear about your own understanding of the concepts, right? Because if these concepts require three paragraphs in order to express them, if you don't understand them well enough to get them down to 15 words, you probably don't understand them well enough. And so that's what we had to do for these kids' books.
Yeah, and the series of videos, they're a blast. They're engaging. They're short. You can go one right after the other. Really well laid out. It's really enjoyable.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because we know that our students are – what students love, it's clear, is they love the mystery. And so we didn't write these as you know, what is true about Christianity, what is true about this, what is true about that. We didn't do it that way. What we did, we said, hey, can we create a mystery unrelated to anything in Christianity, unrelated to anything related to God's evidence for God's existence, just mysteries about, you know, one's about a puppy, one's about a shoebox, one's about a skateboard. Can we create mysteries that'll keep kids turning the page and then kind of Trojan horse in critical thinking skills that'll help them to look at the case for Christianity?
Yeah. And nobody doesn't admire or want to be like the person that can figure something out. That's everybody.
Yeah, there's a sense. Yeah, you know that show Sherlock on TV, or I think it's called, it's several versions of the Sherlock Holmes story now in different series. And I tell you, we love that stuff, right? Because we're like going, how do they figure that? We want to get in the mind of the solver to kind of become that person. So that's what we're trying to do for kids.
Yeah. Now, as I'm opening the book and I started to read it, and I'm just smiling ear to ear, and I'm thinking, this is so much fun. I get to a point where you talk about the three different kinds of faith, about unreasonable faith, blind faith, and forensic faith. And would you just kind of review those for the listeners?
Yeah, and I discovered this, you know, as a guy who was not raised in the church, and I just figured everybody comes to faith the way I did, right? Everyone examines the historical case and looks at the reliability of eyewitnesses. It doesn't work that way, right? But what we discussed, I wanted to kind of just look through Scripture, and I was struck. I was encouraged as a non-believer as I was first reading through the Gospels, because it was clear who was ever writing the Gospels. They were trying to convince us that this stuff actually happened, and that somebody saw it happened, and that this testimony was then somehow being transferred to us, either directly through Matthew and John, or indirectly through Mark, who's sitting at the feet of Peter, or from Luke, who's talking to all the eyewitnesses, he says in the first chapter. So I thought, okay, that's encouraging. You're not asking me to accept a bunch of stuff blindly. And I know how to test eyewitnesses, so the question is, if this is really the work of eyewitnesses, should we believe it? And so I discovered there's three ways to believe something. You can believe something in spite of evidence to the contrary. I would call that an unreasonable belief, right? If you think you can get warts from frogs, well, we know you don't get warts from frogs. We know how you get warts, and that doesn't happen that way. But if you still believe that, you hold an unreasonable belief. Mm-hmm. You can hold several blind beliefs, you know, things that you think are true, but you have no evidence one way or the other. It may not be possible to get evidence one way or the other. We all, you know, can hold those kinds of beliefs, but neither one of those is what Jesus is asking us to do. Like, for example, throughout the Gospel of John, where Jesus says repeatedly, if you don't believe what I'm telling you, at least believe on the evidence of the miracles I've worked in front of you. At least believe on the testimony of John the Baptist. At least believe, as a matter of fact, when John the Baptist has his own doubts and sends his believers, his followers, his disciples, he sends them to Jesus. And they say, Jesus, you know, John's in custody and he wants to know, are you the one? Now, I think Jesus could have responded any number of ways and kind of scolded, you know, John's disciples, or scolded John. Really? I mean, he's my cousin. He doesn't know who I am. He doesn't know that I am. He said this when he baptized me. That's when he realized I was the Messiah. You mean to tell me now he's having doubts? He didn't say any of that. He just did three miracles in front of John's disciples and said, go back and tell John what you just saw. That kind of belief, a belief that is not in spite of evidence to the contrary, or is not blind, but is in fact the most reasonable inference from evidence, but you're always going to have open questions. I get that. That kind of belief that is grounded at the end of an evidence trail, that's what I would call a forensic belief, because you could actually make a case for that publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing that Jesus asked us to have. Yeah, you're going to have doubts.
Yeah.
You're going to have open questions, because every juror and every trial I've ever worked, I can't answer all the questions for my jurors. I can't. I've never have been able to.
Right.
But they have to make a decision, render a verdict in light of the evidence they do have, even though there are some unanswered questions. Well, faith is kind of like that, right? We have good reason to believe this is true, and Jesus gave us that. And he commissioned a bunch of disciples as eyewitnesses of his life and resurrection to tell others about this. But you certainly, there's going to be some open questions. You're going to have to take a step of trust at the end of the evidence trail. That's what Christianity asks you to do.
So in forensic faith, and we're having forensic faith because of the evidence, and the word forensic is the Latin word forensis, which means open court or public. So
yep.
We need to be able to take our faith and make it public. And
that's right.
And have evidence why we have our hope in Christ.
And so in some of this third book for me, the first book, Cold Case Christianity, was just about the case for Christianity and God's crime scenes, the case for God's existence. But then the kids' books do the same thing. They just help kids make the case for those two things. But here, what we're trying to say is, hey, if this is true, you should be able to share this with other people in an open way that is based in some form of reasoning and some form of evidence. And we want kids to be able to – because, by the way, if you think something is true and you understand it and have mastered it well enough to share it with others, there's a good chance that that belief system will be ingrained for the rest of your life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you now know what it's based on. And that's what we want for our young people. When young people are actually out there and can defend what they believe – well, they're basically they've been inoculated then from bad thinking, and that's what we're trying to do with these. And we knew this. Like you said, we had to make this visual, we had to make this interactive. We needed video involved in this. We needed activities that kids could print out.
Yes.
And go back and forth. And some people will use them more than others. That's great. But we've got tons of folks who have sent us pictures of the Honor Cadet wall at casemakersacademy.com has got tons of pictures of students, young students, 8 to 12, who are using and graduating from the academy and getting a certificate, and they like to send us their pictures, so I always post them. But that's the goal. I don't care who you're talking to. For me, because we wrote these books ourselves, we felt like this is the best work we could possibly do, and this is in some ways much more ambitious than the adult books and much more gratifying.
And Jim, when you in your first video that I watched online, and then when you pulled Bailey up, that's when you had me.
Yeah.
And Bailey is your Welsh Corgi, world's
yeah.
cutest dog. So that was really fun, and I know Bailey's in the book.
That is the exploding ball of fur that we have in our house. my friend Frank Turek, who's another apologist, he's got Airedale Terriers, and those are dogs that don't shed, right? Well,
uh-huh.
Well, Bailey is a corgi, and corgis are just explode no matter where they go. So, so every room we have in our house on a daily basis has got corners with just piles of hair. So that's the one thing if I could change about corgis, that'd be the one thing I would change. But she is pretty cute.
And yet Bailey loves Simba, your cat. That I don't understand.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
They've been raised like
because my cat was raised by this corgi. So, he thinks he's a corgi. But let's put these animals in our books. And I wish I had done it earlier, because once you do that, once you put a puppy's face on the cover of a book.
Oh yeah.
Like, everyone wants – there's corgis of Instagram for a reason, okay?
I know.
There's bazillions of pictures of corgis on Instagram. Well, that's why.
Yeah.
So
I don't want to get too far off track, but did you get Bailey as a puppy?
I did, and so we've had her now 9 years. But she's got – corgis have this kind of smile on their face. Some dogs do. They always appear to be smiling.
Yes.
And that's one of the things about corgis that's kind of cool. And so she's got a great disposition. She's a terrible watchdog.
Yeah, but I saw her smile on the video, so you speak the truth. Let me take a break.
Yeah.
J. Warner Wallace is my guest. We're talking about his book, Forensic Faith for Kids, How to Learn to Share the Truth from a Real Detective. We'll also take questions if you have a question about faith and apologetics, 877-933-2484. That's a phone number or a text, 877-933-2484. We'll be right back.
Welcome
back to the show. It's 20 minutes after the hour. My guest, Jay Warner Wallace, has written a book. Did it with his wife, Susie. They've been writing a number of kids' books. This is the third in the series, Forensic Faith for Kids. And I read the book, and it's wonderful. And I'm just looking, Jim, when I was reading something, I think it's in the second or third, chapter one, and I thought this was really powerful. You said, in every case I've investigated, I know you touched on this already, but I want to go back to it. Every case you investigated and presented to a jury, there were some questions I couldn't answer for the jurors. Even great cases built on good evidence have unanswerable questions. But we still ask jurors to make a decision, and they do make a decision in spite of the fact they don't have all the evidence they might like.
Yeah, so true. I mean, I think that's sometimes just the rules of evidence will help us as believers kind of live our lives and struggle with doubt, with because you're always going to have some doubt, right?
Mm-hmm.
The question is it reasonable doubt, or is it just imaginary or possible doubt? Different kinds of categories of doubt in criminal trials, and we have to understand that difference and work through that difference. So I know that young people are going to have questions, and for a lot of young people, they think, if I have a question, that is enough, that's earth-shaking enough to shake me in my confidence. But if you already know that that's a natural part of this process, that you should expect that, and that even solid, good cases are built this way and suffer from unanswered questions. Even when I get a quick verdict from a unanimous jury that convicts somebody, this happens all the time, and I'll go back and debrief the jury afterwards and hear how the case, why I want to learn from my juries, and they'll tell us, this still bugs me. I don't know why. I'm not sure how to resolve this or that, but they had enough good reason. And I've had cases where, just to get really specific, I couldn't tell you how he killed her, where he killed her, when he killed her. He got rid of her body. We never discovered the body. I couldn't tell you where he put the body, how he even made it look like the story he offered later was that she ran off. How did he make it look that way? I couldn't answer any of those questions for my jury, but they had enough evidence to determine that he did it, even though they didn't know precisely how he did it.
Mm.
Well, this is kind of where we are I have enough good evidence, I believe, to infer that God created the universe. Do I know exactly how he did it? No. Those are open questions, some of the first questions I'm going to ask God when I get in front of him. But I can still make a decision. I can still trust reliably that I have a good inference from evidence. I want our young people to realize that, hey, having a question does not mean you can't believe this. This is the case for everything we believe. There's virtually nothing that you believe right now that I could not level some imaginary or possible doubt or some claim against it. You would say, well, yeah, but I don't believe those claims. Okay, fine. But that's not as though there aren't any claims against your beliefs. There are tons. So we have to be ready to help our kids see that so that they can stand firm the first time they're in a setting where a friend or a teacher or just a television program levels an objection. And we have to be ready to help them see that's okay. An objection does not mean a refutation. So you can have objections that don't only go anywhere, and we need to help our kids see those.
Mm-hmm. Jim, I saw you present about 4 years ago. I was just in the middle off to the left at about four tables back on the right.
Maybe. Of course, I remember exactly where you were.
Oh, perfect. Okay. And one of the things I learned from watching you is you inspired me to think, and I was thinking, this guy is determined. That was one thing I walked away with that day. You are a determined person, which I think is probably critical to what you did for a job for so many years. But
yeah, I think passion is transferable, right?
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes we'll see that, well, my kids don't seem like they're interested in this. Well, a lot of it they catch from us. And passion is one of those things you catch, or dispassion you can catch. So I just knew, in my the way I'm wired, when I was an atheist, I was a passionate atheist. And I was absolutely against... and so that's why when I see somebody who's passionately against Christianity, I'm actually encouraged, because I know that's the kind of person that they can be convinced in some way. If God does something in the life of that guy or girl,
yeah,
something crazy is going to happen, because that kind of passion is can be used by God.
Yeah, because they're on a hook of some kind, because they're fighting so hard.
Yeah, well, I just think that's. I mean, I think some of these things, truth doesn't change; it just puts it on steroids. You know, kind of like fame. Fame doesn't change who you are; it just exposes who you are, right?
Yeah.
The same thing happens here. You know, when you come to faith, God uses the way He's already given you these gifts that you have been misusing, and now suddenly He's going to find a way to use them for the kingdom. So get ready. And I remember when I first became a Christian, one of my partners said, "Oh no, I know you. You'll probably end up being a pastor because this is who you are. You're always over the top." You know.
Uh-huh.
And sure enough, he was right. You know, so that's what happens when if you are passionate, and I think that is transferable. We need to transfer it to our kids.
Yeah. So when you call yourself an atheist, were you like a hardcore atheist, like you wanted to convert other people to not believe in God, or were you just had a guy that just had nothing, no interest in God, and he didn't exist? So what's the point?
No, I wasn't actually actively trying to. Here's why: because I wasn't in an environment where I met a lot of Christians.
Okay.
The five people we were taken to jail.
Okay.
Most of them, they would often say they were Christians, but a lot of my fellow officers were not believers. So I just was not in an environment where, you know, I think sometimes we seek out people who are like us, and a lot of that, you know, this is back in the early 90s, and so. The internet was still in its kind of – social media for sure was in its infancy. So there wasn't – you know, back in those days, you could really surround yourself with like-minded people, and you would really have no exposure like we have now. The whole world is open to our kids, by the way. So the places where you might encounter a skeptic when I was a kid – well, that's going to be a school, I guess, or be in the workplace – but now you can be 13 years old and you're encountering – if you just Google something about Christianity, Google the Trinity. Just say Trinity. And you will find on the first page of results more non-Christian responses, more atheist responses than you will Christian responses. So almost any theological claim, if you search for it, you'll find more negativity than you will positivity.
Mm.
And so this is true. When our kids do this, they're seeing the world the way it really is in terms of the opposition. And the opposition is not – I mean, talk about this new atheism. There's nothing really new. There's no new objection against Christianity. There's just a new attitude about those who object. You've seen what's happened in the public discourse. The same thing has happened in the discourse about religion or about theology, is we've kind of lost our decorum. You know, it's like we don't have a problem calling each other out across the aisle and screaming at each other. And that's the kind of the tenor of the stuff our kids are seeing on you know, you're an idiot. It's not just that you're wrong, is that if you don't hold my position, you're not just wrong, you're evil. You know,
that
kind of extreme position, our kids see that too. So it's not just that the opposition is saying, well, Christianity isn't true. It's saying, no, Christianity is destructive and evil and immoral and limiting and disrespectful of human rights and women's rights and sexual rights and all kinds of these things, right? So our kids are hearing this all the time, and that's just the way – that's just the environment we're living in. I don't think – I'm not one of these folks who, like, wrings my hands about it, because I was on that side for so many years, and I know God will do what God will do. And if God could bring me, He can bring anybody. Mm. So I typically have more patience when I see somebody who doesn't believe. I'm not panicked, because I know that if you'd have met me a year before I became a Christian, and people would say this, that guy will never be a Christian. And look what happened.
Yeah.
So I just know that this is something that I'm not in charge of. This is something God does, and does it well.
Yeah. J. Warner Wallace is my guest. If you have a question for him or want to get involved in this discussion, please call 877-933-2484. Again, 877-933-2484 with any question. That will also work as a text if you want to text me, or bill@myfaithradio.com will get me the question as well. I'll ask on your behalf. Be back in just a minute with more J. Warner Wallace. Welcome back to the show. It's 31 minutes after the hour. J. Warner Wallace is my guest. He's written a number of books, Forensic Faith, and he's written a version for kids. So learn how to share the truth from a real detective. And it's geared for a younger audience, but I have to tell you, I picked up the book and then couldn't put it down, because I'm reminded once again, A, how hard it is to reduce something down so the simplest mind can grasp it, which Jim has done a brilliant job of doing this. But also that it's just a fun read. And if you have kids or grandkids, you're going to want to pick this book up. can do that at Amazon.com. And also has a lot of video support that you go on and you watch little six-minute videos, and you get worksheets to do and a certificate at the end, and you have become a detective and solved a crime, which is awfully nice. Jim, I just had a caller named Paul who said, would you ask Jim his personal testimony, what was it that caused him to trust Christ coming out of atheism?
Okay, so I know that that you and I have talked about this, so I'm going to say something controversial, okay?
Okay.
I get this question a lot, like, what is your testimony? And I typically say the same thing every time I get the question. I'll tell you my testimony, but my testimony does not matter. And to be honest, either does yours. Because the reality of what matters is this true?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because everyone offers a testimony. I've got six brothers and sisters, half-brothers and sisters, who my stepmother raised Mormon. And all of them have a testimony, and they will be willing to offer it. But that testimony does not make Mormonism true. And it also doesn't make Christianity true.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, because I knew I couldn't just trust that, you know, I'm so skeptical and so suspicious of people's reports of experiences, because I think these can be described a number of ways, right? I mean, every Mormon person I know has had some experience, some burning in the bosom experience, or they may not describe it that way anymore, but the point is they've had some experience that is experiential that they will say it demonstrates that Mormonism is true, that Joseph Smith is a prophet of God. Well, okay, I'm hesitant. I'm skeptical of those. Even in my own experiences, I'm skeptical. Am I reading this the wrong way? I need to know, first, is there good evidence for this? And I am a cumulative case guy. So I would probably never be comfortable going into trial with one witness, and that's it. My whole case comes down to one witness and what he or she says. I'm going to need a bunch of stuff that corroborates her or him and that points to the same logical, reasonable inference. And so finally, it's the weight of 80 pieces of evidence that point to the same inference that I'm asking my juries. And, you know, listen, I get it. I call this, by the way, this process death by 1,000 paper cuts, right? Because it's not like any one of these little things would necessarily be enough to convince any one jury. But after I overwhelm them with a huge cumulative case, they're like, okay, I'm already over it. Let's just vote. And that's what we're trying to do, right? So for me with Christianity, there wasn't one thing that – and this is why it wasn't an instantaneous – I mean, I was presented with the person of Jesus of Nazareth by a pastor here locally here in Southern California, who initially just described Jesus as the smartest man who had ever lived. And upon whose moral teaching from just a couple of speeches, a couple of sermons, because I wouldn't have called them sermons back then, really that teaching became the foundation for Western civilization. That was the claim of this pastor. And that was enough to get me started. And then it was 1,000 paper cuts. You know, it was me slowly reading through the Gospels. I did a forensic statement analysis on Mark's Gospel. I researched all the possible corroboration, a lot of church history, a lot of early first century history that wasn't Christian. I mean, I'm looking at all the ways that we make reliable or demonstrate that they're not reliable witnesses in criminal trials. We have a process. And that was the process I used. And it takes time. I mean, it takes time in a real trial. I mean, my cases take years to develop. That's why only, you know, you can't do, if you've done, you know, really hard cases, you probably haven't done a few because these things take forever. I have one case took me 11 years start to finish. So these are cases that take forever. In the case for Christianity, I would say I probably spent 6 months. You know, the internet was still pretty primitive in terms of what it could offer me. And I had never heard of a Christian apologetics. So I wish I would have heard of it because I probably would have tapped. I just thought you have to go back to first century sources. And that was hard to find. You had to buy books because there weren't good resources online.
Those old days.
I know, right? Yeah, so I had a whole shelf of books that was just – and for a long time I had a shelf that was nothing but notebooks of stuff I had compiled.
Yeah,
that was that process. But there was no tipping. That's just the nature of death by 1,000 paper cut cases. They are cumulative and they take forever to build.
Yeah, Jim, I've always said that my faith is a decision making process based on the Word of God without regard to my emotions.
Yeah, boy, that's a good. You know, that's and so here's the problem I have, and you maybe feel this way too, is that for those of us who have had a more rational, not to say that the other side is not rational, but what I mean is a more intellectual or a more evidence-based approach to coming into this, people will say to me, well, yeah, but has the God spirit, do you have, in other words, they're looking for some kind of emotional, intellectual balance. And most of the people I know who are Christians are really leaning heavily toward their emotional reasoning, their intuitions, their emotional thought processes, right? Whereas I'm leaning heavy toward my evidence-based kind of thought processes. And I think the people I know struggle to come back to a reasonable middle from that emotional edge. I struggle to come back to a reasonable middle from that rational edge, right? Because I know people who will go into worship services and they are so emotionally struck by the kind of music, by the words and what am I doing? I'm looking at it as a musician, and I'm like going, oh, I see how he's doing that. I'm parsing out the measures and saying, well, how's that bass player playing that line?
Uh-huh.
What am I doing? This is just the way I'm wired.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have to struggle with that, to let go of that, to say, okay, I've already decided this is true. Can I just relax a little bit, you know, and just bask in the moment? And that is a struggle for me. I think it's a struggle for a lot of us who are apologists, who are trying to help others who have just an entirely emotional foundation for their faith see what their reasoning is. Well, I have to have somebody help me let go of that reasoning on occasion and just relax and let God's spirit kind of move.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not emotional about gravity, are you?
Yeah, see, I'm not. And that's kind of the argument I've always made is also – I don't think emotional responses help you in the job that I'm in. I think you can't remember you can't get emotional about death scenes because you'll be emotional all the time,
right,
and you won't be able to do your job. And
right,
and you can't get angry at people because you'll hate every guy who's committed a murder you have to interview. You have to stay relatively dispassionate or unemotional in order to do this well. And so there's only a few people probably in my life who I would show that side of me to anyway. But my wife probably is the only one who really knows, sees any balance in that regard. For the most part, cops are cynical by nature. That serves us well. We're pessimists. We assume the worst in people because that's how people go to jail. If you assume the best in people,
right,
no one goes to jail. So I think no one even gets caught for the crimes they've committed. So we have to really kind of balance. And I think that's a struggle for all of us. But again, I think God uses every one of us in spite of the way because of the way he's gifted us. He can, and that's why we're not, solo Christians. We are part of a team.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we do. God uses my gifts in this area to help somebody who's got gifts that I don't have, and vice versa.
Yeah, I just want to back up a little bit, Jim, because when you're talking about your faith and your family that are all passionate about what they believe based on how they feel, and I think you and I have come to that place together where we say, well, I want to believe in the truth and the truth only,
right,
and I believe in Christianity because it's true. Now, will it make me happy? Yes. Will it make me emotional? Of course. But I didn't come to that decision based on emotion. I came on it based on the truth of what the Scripture has taught me and what I've learned from it.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. That is exactly what we want to do. But the problem, of course, is that some of us are more inclined to take that approach anyway. It's
mm-hmm.
not like we have to try that hard to be that guy or be that gal. That's just how we're wired. So I think what we're, it's that transformation of your mind, right? It's that being transformed in our thoughts and allowing. But my problem is letting your guard. At what point do you kind of have a more balanced approach to your religious experience, your experience of God, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think here's what we need right now. I'll tell you this. Look, we are in a point. If somebody in your family has cancer, you are going to go to an extreme edge with chemotherapy and use chemicals that really are designed to kill us, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they're killing those cancer cells. And it's really – there's a risk involved, and it's way over to the edge. This is nothing you would ever want to put in your body on any other occasion. But you're going to use that because you've got to solve a problem. And then once you are healed, you will be able to move back toward normalcy. And I think what we have right now in our culture, the Christian culture, is we are at a point of crisis, right? I mean, how much longer will we wait as a church and allow our numbers to shrink – allow our young people to be convinced by the culture that Christianity is not true, how much longer will we make? It might be a time for us to do something drastic, which means we might need to push this pendulum out to the outside rational edge to help our young people know that it is true. Because if we don't, that whole emotional, when I ask young people still, and I teach at Summit Worldview Conference in Colorado, that's all high schoolers. I'm on college campuses regularly, just at Ohio State last month. We do these Rethink Apologetics conferences. We just had 2,200 high schoolers last Friday night at a conference here in Southern California. And when I ask young kids, why are you a Christian? The overwhelming answer, overwhelming, is I've been raised that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a Christian home.
They come by it honestly.
Well, yeah, that's not going to get it done, folks. I wish it would, but this is what everyone says. This is why most Muslims are Muslim, why most Buddhists are Buddhists, why most Mormons are Mormons.
Mm-hmm.
They've been raised in that setting. That is the number one determiner of future beliefs. What were the beliefs of your parents? Not everyone, but most.
Yeah.
That's how they get there.
Jim,
that doesn't mean it's true.
Yeah. Jim, would you say that now more than ever, kids need to be equipped and able to defend the truth that they believe about Jesus?
Well, I'll tell you this. We just did a poll. I wrote an article for Fox News on this, just talking about why ex-Christians are ex-Christians, according to the latest research. And, you know, we did a Pew Research poll probably around 2015, and they've been kind of parsing through that poll ever since until they did the next one. And what they saw were lots of folks would step out of Christianity and say they now have no religious identity. They would say that they're called the religious nuns. They check the box that says, you know, with whom do you affiliate? None. So N-O-N-E-S.
Mm-hmm.
These are the nuns. And this group is growing, right? It's in the 20th percentile, 22, 23, 24%. These are people who used to claim Christianity, but the vast majority of them used to call themselves Christians. And they'll say, they gave them a multiple choice. You know, they went back to those folks and they said, you know, did another little survey where they said, hey, you know, they gave them multiple choice. What was it that caused you to leave? And because of the multiple choice nature of it, it doesn't always capture, right? So, for example, they gave them these choices, and 51% agreed with this statement. They questioned a lot of religious teaching. 46% said they didn't like the positions their churches held on social or political issues. To a lesser extent, about 34% said they just didn't like religious organizations, or 31% said they didn't like religious leaders, or 26% said it just was irrelevant to them. Okay, great. But when they asked them, you know, which of these was the primary reason why you left, they confessed that actually none of those were the primary reason why I left. I mean, they would agree with those statements, but that wasn't the primary reason why they left. Okay, so what is it? I mean, they don't like that. By the way, we need as a church to recognize that young people disagree with the teaching of Scripture. Sorry, a lot of them do. You saw here, they don't like the positions their churches take on social or political issues. Well, if it's just the social issues, what's driving that? It's this revolution that's taking place right now that seems to be contrary to the biblical teaching on a number of things, mostly around sex. So, I mean, those are things we've got to have to deal with. But when you ask them, on a 2 years ago, they asked on an open survey, just give me the reasons why you left. No multiple choice. You can't choose from multiple choice. And that's what's really revealing. And here's what they said when they filled in their own answers. This is some of their responses. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
They said, learning about evolution when I went away to college was one reason. Religion is the opiate of the people. You've heard that before, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rational thought makes religion go out the window, one person said. A lack of any sort of specific evidence, rather, for a creator, was another person said. Or I just realized somewhere along the line that I didn't really believe this. Or I'm doing a lot more learning, studying, and kind of making decisions myself rather than listening to someone else. In other words, the vast majority of responses had something to do with intellectual skepticism. Some smaller number of responses had to do with, you know, maybe hypocrisy they saw in the church or a bad experience they had in church. But when left to their own answers, where they can fill in anything they want, the overwhelming majority of young people said they left because they had some form of intellectual skepticism. So I'm just trusting them to tell me what the real issue is. And if that is the real issue, of course, you know, the surveyors wanted to think, well, it's got to be some kind of moral position that your church holds. Well, they some of them agreed with that, but they said that's not the real issue. The real issue are these issues. Well, then we can actually address those issues because we can actually make a case for why Christianity is true. We can show them what the connection between science and religious belief is. These are things we could actually address, right? I mean,
yeah.
I try to do this in God's Crime Scene. I try to do this in Cold Case Christianity. And so we actually can – and that's why I think, yeah, now is the time. If this is what they are saying the problem is, well, that's a problem we could address.
Yeah,
and that's why I think we have to make resources to address those issues.
I love it. Jim, let me take a break. Jay Warner Wallace is my guest. We're talking about a book and a series he's written for kids. This is called Forensic Faith. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Minutes until the top of the hour. Jay Warner Wallace is my guest. He's written a series of books for kids. This one's called Forensic Faith. It is a page turner. I just loved it. And there's a place on the web you can go and see videos all about the book. You can download work pages and get a degree and everything else. So I'm going to get my degree and get it framed professionally. So I've got one diploma on my wall, Jim. That's my goal.
Well, it's designed so you can use crayons to color it. So I expect they have really well colored. I want to see that before.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know Susie, your wife helped write this. Do you recall some things that kids have said to you? Questions about God that really kind of took you aback or made you smile, or you know, kids always say the greatest things. So do you have a couple of things that kids have questioned or have asked about God?
Yeah. No. Absolutely. And I get these from usually. Surprised, the parents are surprised by the level of sophistication in the question. You know, sometimes it could be depending on the age. You know, I've got a 6-year-old just says, "Hey, but Mom, why is this? Why do you think this Bible is true? Do you think it's telling us something true? Why do you believe it?" That's something simple.
Yeah.
Especially when you're coming across passages that seem, in a world that is constantly reflecting a philosophically natural worldview. In other words, a worldview in which everything is supposed to be explained by just physics and chemistry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Acting on space, time, and matter. That's all there is. There are no immaterial things. You'll see this sometimes in television shows. You'll see it's just a very subtle, right? So that means then when we get to a place where something supernatural occurs, some miracle occurs in Scripture, and that's like a lot of places, right? That's when I think kids will say, "What? Really? Did that really happen?" That's a very simple thing to get. Did that really happen?
Mm-hmm.
And then the question becomes, well, okay, so how do we respond to that? So I get those kinds of questions from parents and from kids all the time. And I get more specific questions like, you know, I had a 9-year-old who didn't think that Jesus really lived. And he knew enough about claims made online to say that he thought he was just copied from a copycat. Copycat saviors was the expression.
Wow.
And I don't think he made that up. He heard that somewhere else, right? And he actually knew that one of the alleged mythologies that Jesus had been copied from was a deity named Mithras. And I thought, wow, you know, for a 9-year-old, that's pretty sophisticated.
Yeah,
right?
It is.
I mean, and so what that means is that, you know, if you look at the number of young people in elementary school who have access at least to their parents' smartphone, or they have access maybe where they're not as monitored as maybe you might think they are, and they're online. They're even in social media. I mean, some kids have social media platforms, right? Our kids were kind of grew up at a time when not everybody had that, and so it was a little bit easier to limit some of that, right? Because it was just still kind of becoming prominent, so we didn't have to have my kids have smartphones until they were out of high school. But you'll see that a lot of people by junior high, they've got smartphones. Well, that opens up the entire world to skepticism,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is fine, which is great. But if we don't first start talking about why things are true, because I have no problem with all the alternatives that are out there. You know, for example, you know, there's all kinds of alternative things to eat, but at some point you decide what you're going to eat, you eat what you want to eat, and you ignore all the alternatives. Well, the same thing has to happen here. We have to be so directed and so specific and purposeful about our talking about our beliefs with our kids that they recognize the counterfeit when they see it. So it can still sit out there and it's not going to have any impact on them. And this is that idea of inoculation theory, right? This idea that we get an inoculation for the flu, we get a little dose of the flu, and then our body learns to fight it. So when the larger exposure to flu comes, it's already learned how to fight that from exposure to the smaller dose. Well, I always say that I want my young people, as a youth pastor, I wanted to make sure that my high schoolers, when they graduated and went to university, that they would not hear a single objection that they didn't get from me first. So I wanted to make sure that I was well-read, that I knew what the objections were, and that I could articulate those to young people so they would not hear them for the first time when they weren't in my presence, right? Where they would have access to resources that would guide them to the truth. And by the way, this is what the other side wants to do too, right? They want to get people in a place where they are the authority that presents something without any objection from the other side. Everyone's doing this. I think it's fair for us. It's not a matter of indoctrination. It's a matter of inoculation, which is just, you know, we all want to do that. Both sides want to do that for their own kids.
Yeah, Jim, I know a lot of people get a little bit nervous and scared about defending their faith, and I think they don't believe they're well equipped enough. But to defend your faith and to tell people about Jesus, you don't. Most people that you're talking to are completely biblically illiterate. So to give them childlike simple truths, just like the ones in your book. I mean, it's such a great refresher course for all minds and all ages.
Well, look, I mean, all of us are challenged to prioritize the things that are most, I mean, and you know what your things are important to you by just show me your calendar. and we know that. I mean, I know that as a parent. I know that as a believer. I know that my calendar and my pocketbook, you know, my checkbook, well, I don't have a checkbook anymore. It's all, you know, debit cards. Mm-hmm. But my point is your bank statement will give you away and tell you what it is you value more. What are you spending your time on? You know, there's this. We've kind of moved away from this concept of spiritual disciplines, but there are some disciplines that I am committed to related to my workout schedule, related to my running schedule. We run, you know, we're going to run every other day, rain or shine. We're disciplined about that. If you're listening to this right now, there's something you're disciplined about. It may just be that, you know, if it's Thursday night, last night you probably watched the football game, right? Because you have a discipline in which you schedule those kinds of things. Well, how many hours do we spend doing that kind of stuff?
A lot.
I mean, how many hours do I spend watching and thinking about football?
A lot.
I got to tell you, it's ridiculous, right? So at some point, my wife and I said, we got to get back to a discipline of daily Bible reading and prayer that we do together. And we have to make that because you've seen the statistics. This is another thing I've researched, and it drives me crazy, just those statistics that show how many people own a Bible but how few ever open it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the recent studies show that 87% of American households own a Bible, okay? And about 53% ever open them. About 19% will say they read it every day. So although there's a lot of Bibles out there in households across America, you know, very few people are actually reading it every day, and they're probably lying about it, you know. So,
So
I think those numbers are probably high on the survey.
Right.
And so that they'll be surprised then when they do surveys related to Christian worldview to see, okay, if you're a believer, you say you're a Christian, what does that even mean? And they'll ask them kind of some simple doctrinal questions about the deity of Christ, about the triune nature of God, some of the things that Christians believe, and they find out that most Christians don't believe those things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they haven't opened their Bible, and they don't believe what Christianity teaches, but they call themselves Christians, right?
We
all do this in some category in our life.
Yeah.
But those are the groups that I look at. I say, man, in those households, those young people are the most at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And that is probably the majority of Christian households. So if you're listening to this right now and you're worried about the next generation of Christians, well, no, number one, most young Christians who walk away from the church, they do this between the ages of 10 and 17. It doesn't happen in college. It's happening while they're still with us. That's embarrassing,
mm-hmm.
and it's kind of bad news, but it's good news because we actually can impact that number because they're still with us while they're making a decision
right.
that Christianity is not true. And number two, it all starts with us. We have to, number one, show it's, you know, we always say this, this kind of thing is caught more than it's taught.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to really make sure that we're throwing something at our kids that they can catch and that we're throwing it in a way that is catchable.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of what we're trying to do with kids' books, right?
Yeah.
We know that this we have to throw it in a way that kids can
right.
catch.
Jim, is the best website coldcasechristianity.com? Is that
yeah,
where they should start?
Yeah, everything is linked there. Yeah, the Casemakers Academy. Everything is linked
okay.
to that site, so that's probably the best place.
Awesome. Jay Warner Wallace has been my guest, and his book is Forensic Faith for Kids, Learn to Share the Truth from a Real Detective. It's an absolute delightful book. You will love it. And if you've got kids or grandkids, you will have a great time going through this. Jim, thank you so much for coming onto the show. Always great to talk to you.
Thanks, brother. Glad to be with
you. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Yep. So you can head over to Amazon.com and check out Jim's books. He's got several of them, and also ColdCaseChristianity.com. You can learn more about Jim. I've seen him on Dateline and a number of other programs, and he is such a brilliant thinker. You're not going to regret getting a copy of any one of his books. Have a great weekend, everybody. I hope you get some rest, and I will see you Monday. God bless everyone.
Hallelujah, when I lay my burdens down.
Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.